deep dive into water safety. And now, your host, Margaret.
Good morning, Annie.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us in studio here today.
Well, here we are in December. I think we've done about 24 interviews so far.
24. Wow.
So we're going to just highlight a couple of those today. You and I had discussed running one video, one piece in the beginning of the show, but we decided to run something else instead, which is the Bondi Beach lifeguard rescue piece. Bruce Hopkins was one of our first interviewers that we had, and he's going to be talking about some rip current demonstrations in the first highlight that we do. So what we'd like to do is play this piece that was done in Australia 2 days ago, interviewing Bruce Hopkins about the rescue.
Yeah, and it's wild because it kind of sets up lifeguards as first responders, and this was a horrific
incident.
Massacre mm-hmm. incident during a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach, where people are being safe and having fun, and lifeguards stepped in as first responders.
Right. So let's take a listen.
Okay. Also, I just want to let you guys know that this is Deep Dive into Water Safety, where we explore all sorts of water safety techniques, ideas, and we're trying to get people to work together for more safety in
right.
Hawaii Island. We're stoked. So let's turn over to this news report.
Home, their office, and their happy place. And the lifeguards at Bondi won't let anything change that. They were among the first to leap into action on Sunday. They didn't think twice, protecting the people and the place they love. Today, they're doing the same. A moment of comfort after what's been the hardest few days of not just their careers, but their lives.
Still lots of process. Speaking to all the boys and hanging out with them, just processing it in our own way, taking the time and just speaking to each other about it.
Lifeguard Rory Davey is debriefing with his mates and colleagues who were there when terror broke out on Bondi.
It's a tragic thing that's happened, but like for me, my safe space is the water down there. So I've got in this morning and it's just made me feel a bit better.
Hopper, how is everybody doing today?
Oh, look, after an incident like that, everybody's a bit rattled and we're trying to come to terms with what happened. And so it's something that is out of the ordinary and the guys are trying to deal with it the best they can.
Bondi Lifeguard Coordinator Bruce Hopkins, better known as Hoppo, couldn't be more proud of his team. Lifeguards don't usually like being called heroes, but today there's no better way to describe them.
How brave they were to run in and be helping people and treating them and you know, resuscitation in the moments where the gunmen are still firing bullets. It's an amazing effort.
When the sound of gunfire rang out on Sunday, our lifeguards ran straight into the danger. It's absolute chaos, and in that moment, none of them knew how many gunmen there were, where they were, whether they would be fired at, did they? But they didn't hesitate.
No, didn't hesitate. They didn't know there could have been 10 gunmen. There were bullets going everywhere. People were getting hit while they were trying to do the CPR. Without any second thought, they ran straight in to help as many as they could.
Lifeguard Jackson Doolan was at Tamarama Beach, almost 2 kilometres away. He ran to Bondi, barefoot, defibrillator in tow.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And it's become an iconic picture of the heroism of that day.
Yeah, extraordinary to think of, you know, I'm just going to grab it. It's not a short distance either from Tamarama, running barefoot to Bondi and carrying all that gear. You know, that shows the passion of the lifeguards. They want to help their fellow lifeguard. They want to help people that are in trouble.
Rescue boards became makeshift stretchers. The local clubhouse transformed into a triage centre. Tommy Woodruff was off duty, but he got straight to work, rendering first aid to a young man hit in the leg. A police officer was shot close by.
He was only probably 50 metres or 100 metres from the gunman at that time, and it was easily he could have been shot as well, but jumped in and to help the police woman.
Down at the water, Rory Davey jumps in to save swimmers struggling in the panic.
They ran into where the rips were. People were starting to drown. And he's run into the water while the bullets are still getting fired, and he's pulling people in and rescue them.
Meanwhile, swimmers huddle behind a patrol buggy as Lucas Street Wong keeps watch.
Whole beach sort of spread and huddle behind the buggy, and then we're kind of like, all right, we're sort of here for the people. They need us as well now, right now. At that stage, it was complete unknown. Like, that was the scariest part. We didn't know how many shooters there were, where they were, who they were targeting. It was just crazy to see the hysteria on the beach and so many people just scared for their lives.
This is your patch. This is your beach. This is a place of joy and family. And it's sickening, isn't it? Like, how are you coping with it?
Oh, look, it's tough to deal with. You know, you've grown up in the area all your life and you never think something is going to happen like this. And worked there, and it's a credit to, you know, Daniel McLaughlin, who was the coordinator on the day, coordinated everybody and got them up into the park, and, you know, Michael Jenkinson and Mario and all the other guys that were running in. It's a credit to them and makes me proud to be a part of that team, and shows that the training we do and the experience has really paid off in this incident.
Beachgoers have returned to Bondi and lifeguards back to work, reclaiming the place that brings them so much joy, just 3 days after it was changed forever.
The Jewish community suffered great loss. The Australian community suffered great loss. And that's something that we truly, really want to put out there, that from us, we are so sorry that this has happened.
Lifeguard coordinator Daniel McLaughlin.
We want those flags up and we want everyone back there, because the beach is for everyone. It always has been and it always will be.
I'm getting together with these boys, and the amount of support we've gotten from the public and the team has just been overwhelming, seriously. It's like almost emotional part of it as well, just getting all that out.
We are so extraordinarily grateful, and you look after those boys, and I know that you will all look after each other.
We'll look after each other and make sure we all come out the other end and get back down the beach and save people's lives, which is what we love doing.
That was a really moving piece.
Yes, if you actually see the visual, it's even more so. But I reached out to Bruce for us and told him that we were really sorry and supported everything they were doing. And I think that interview showed that lifeguards are first responders and are real heroes when there's real tragedies that happen. And so I think this whole show is trying to show that, and that water safety is important, and that our lifeguards play a huge role in that. And everybody should respect the guards.
Yes, for sure. It's almost like, you know, Baywatch, Babes on Beach, and it looks all... I feel like that has done almost a disservice to our perception of what lifeguards are.
Well, Drasko Bogdanovic will be on the show in the beginning of the year. He has a show called The Lifeguard Project, which a lot of the guards have told me about. It's very, very well done. He has a piece, besides interviewing and photography, he also writes pieces. And he writes a piece called Red Isn't Armor, but we'll talk about that during his interview.
Okay.
Which talks about the myths of being a lifeguard.
Nice. I think that's really good. So next up, we've got Bruce Hopkins.
So yes, Bruce is the person that they interviewed. He's head of the Bondi lifeguards. He is going to talk here in this quick piece that we've highlighted from his interview about rip current demonstrations.
Okay, let's take a listen.
So the experience is what helps when you do actually get in it, because you've already been in and experienced it. It's like going watching a TV or getting briefed in a classroom on how to drive a car and just hand the people keys and never driven a car and off you go and drive a car. So most things we do in life, we experience. So that's how that idea came about. Let's put people in the rips. Now, if it's people that are reasonably confident or they say that they can float. Now, floating is, it's not just people think floating's a starfish, just on your back, feet up. Because I do a lot of work with the swim schools,
they teach to do the starfish, and what happens is they tell them keep your feet up, your toes out of the water. And I said, why do you say keep your toes out of the water? And no one really had an answer. I said, well, your toes don't need to breathe, because a lot of people struggle to keep their legs up. And I said, but your toes don't need to breathe, so why do they need to be up? And they go, oh yeah, fair point. I said, so basically everybody's floating position is different. There's not one floating position. So you can go back like a dentist chair position. If you're going backwards, you're not in a starfish, so your legs can drop, and you might do a little bit of sculling with your hands to keep yourself, you know, afloat. You could be doing the old school tread water, you know, moving your arms and legs, or you can be forward in a more of a like a light breaststroke, or just moving your hands on your stomach that way. And I found that they're probably the three main positions people go to. So when they get in there, you go, just find your comfortable position. As long as your head's above water and you're not using your energy, whatever position that's comfortable for you, that's the position you do. And that's what's been working, because what's happened is we've been trying to teach people, oh, you do the starfish, or you do this, you do that, a technical side of it. Now, everyone can't do a technical side of, you know, it's the same as swimming, same as running. Everyone runs different on land.
That's a really...
So that's one thing that came about. And when I looked at it, that all rips will pull across or come at that end point. Rivers are the same. If you get caught going down river, it'll pull you to the side of the bank somewhere. It might be 100 metres, might be a kilometre down river, but it will take you to the side of the bank somewhere. And the other thing, if it doesn't, you don't save yourself, the longer you can float gives you time. So it gives you time for someone to come and rescue you, whether it's a lifeguard, whether it's a surfer, whether it's someone in a boat or someone, whatever it is, the longer you can float, you can then be rescued. And it's amazing when you're trying to swim as fast as you can, you're puffing, exhausted. Once you go into a float position, you can then, your breathing comes back to normal. The panic starts going, because I always hear people say, oh, when you're caught in a rip, stay calm. Well, what, if you're panicking, what, now I've got to be calm. You need an action to be able to become calm.
Right.
So that's the action to become calm, because you just can't. And if you're in a panic, no matter what you're doing in life, whether you're driving a car, and you panic, and you just go, I just got to stay calm. How do you stay calm? It's an action that makes you then become calm. So it all tied in, and we just started trialing it, and I was getting in rips, and we had experienced people doing it in the first place, and then I felt, well, the only way to test it is just grab people. And you probably saw the one on the show, or wherever you saw it, or videos.
Yep.
I was just grabbing people, randoms off the beach, and said, do you want to jump in a rip with me? And they were jumping in. Some had never been in a rip before. And we're just talking and drifting along, and they didn't know which way they were going and what they were doing. And then I said, just stand up. And all of them said, oh, is that all I've got to do? Is that it? You know, we're just talking. They didn't even realize. So it definitely works.
Can you imagine this lifeguard comes up to you on the beach and says, hey, want to jump in a rip current with me?
Well, it's more structured than that. And the good news, which we haven't talked about, there's been a lot of progress since we started this program. And here's an example. Bruce Hopkins is in discussion with Kalani Vieira coming out here and being part of Rip Current demonstrations. He identified Grandpa's Pine Trees, Back Channel in Anini, and Kealia. And so it's probably because of this incident, that discussion hasn't happened yet. It will happen after the first of the year.
Yeah.
And figuring out a time when he can come out. He's a internationally known star, really, because he ran Bondi Rescue for like 18 seasons.
Yeah, and that's a show, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And so the idea that Bruce Hopkins would come and collaborate with our head
That's
of
correct.
Ocean Safety Bureau.
Right. And our guards.
To learn about how to be in a
sure.
rip current.
Right.
Awesome.
So it would give people information instead of just looking at a video, which, you know.
Mm-hmm. Also, I want to give you props on air, Margaret, for starting this discussion and connecting these people.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, right okay. on. So next we've got Dr. Semstrat.
Yes, Dr. Semstrat was a lifeguard and now an ER doc, and his interview was great. He helped with the U.S. Water Safety Plan and had a lot of good things to say about the Hawaii Water Safety Plan. But I picked this segment, which people haven't heard, which is about CPR, and especially for parents.
Nice. Here we go. This is Dr. Semstrat.
CPR, when I was younger, in the 90s, in early 2000s, really focused on doing compressions and rescue breaths. But rescue breaths can be doing mouth-to-mouth, mouth-to-mask can be technically difficult. And if we look at the big picture of about 300,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests every year in the U.S., so that's your from trauma, from drowning, from sudden cardiac arrest, from kidney failure, from diabetes, from everything, about a quarter of those are caused by an electrical disturbance in the heart that can be treated with an AED. So from a public health perspective, that 25% is the easiest to treat for a bystander, because the treatment is compression-only CPR and using an AED to shock them back into a normal rhythm as early as possible. And so part of the reason why that mid to late 2000s shift in CPR education came, because from a public health standpoint, this was the easiest to teach. And many people had that barrier of, I don't want to take a CPR class because I don't want to do mouth to mouth on a stranger. And so if we empower them to do compression only CPR until an AED arrives, then that is amazing. The asterisk is that only treats sudden cardiac arrest from those electrical disturbances called VF and VT. So now somebody that's drowning, who has an otherwise healthy, normal heart, who's underwater, their oxygen level starts to drop 100%, 75%, 50%, 0%. At some point, the heart runs out of enough oxygen to keep beating. So when you pull them out of the water, if you're doing compression-only CPR, you're only circulating blood that has no oxygen. So you have to do breaths and compressions. And that's both for professional rescuers and for parents, soccer moms and dads, accountants and lawyers that are taking CPR classes. And one of the big take-home messages that I always give to parents is, we see many fire departments, workplaces, at the airport, right? Teach anyone CPR in 15 minutes, this 1 hour community CPR class. Corporate brings in the local fire department to do it on a catered lunch break. And that is wonderful if you're learning CPR for your spouse, for your parent that's living with you, for some of those other populations. Yes, this happens to young people as well, but predominantly that's for an older aging population. If you're taking a CPR class because you have a pool, because you have children, then you need to take the full weekend course that includes instruction on how to do breaths and compressions, because that's the CPR that's needed both in the hospital, pre-hospital, and bystander settings for drowning for kids. And I love giving the analogy of, you can imagine if my heart has stopped because all of my blood is outside of my body from a traumatic injury. No amount of chest compressions and AED are going to restart my heart. You have to put blood back in. So if my heart has stopped because I'm out of oxygen, no amount of compression only and an AED is going to restart my heart without putting that oxygen back in also.
That's good advice. For parents, breaths and compression, CPR, is what's needed. And this is from an ER pediatric doctor who has been a lifeguard and is part of the United States Lifeguard Association and many other organizations. So we were really pleased to have him on, and he gave us great information.
For sure, for sure. And a lot of that, see, like, I was listening to it going, huh, that does make sense. Like, huh, you're right. No problem. So our next clip is from Dr. Yanigahara.
Yes, this is very interesting. She is director of the Nidaria Research Laboratory. She's a biochemist and toxinologist at the University of Hawaii in Manoa, and she's the leading person internationally recognized for her groundbreaking work on venomous marine invertebrates, particularly the box jellyfish, as she talks about Alautina alata and bluebottle, which people call the Portuguese man of war, but she says it's called bluebottle in the Pacific. She gives a great interview, Biology 101, but we've decided to take a clip about what was really important about messaging and the myths and the protocols for a sting, and she's got a product called Sting No More.
It is very interesting. So this is an 11-minute clip, so I want to do our legal stuff before we play Dr. Yanigahara's clip, but stay tuned because it is very interesting and influences newly protocols that we're going to have with our ocean safety.
Right. There's some progress that's made from this interview.
Another props to you. Oh, gosh, stop doing it. She's waving her arms at me, guys. It's amazing. So you're listening to Kauai Community Radio. This is Margaret Wright, our host of Deep Dive into Water Safety, and I'm Annie. So you ready for Dr. Yanigahara's interview?
Yes. She's going to tell us about the correct protocols for jellies, but she's also the person who made the swim for Diane Nyad successful with her protocol. She swam with her for the entire 100 miles. This woman's a researcher, but she's also a water person. She's very interesting.
And so she swam with her to sort of like...
From Cuba to Florida.
Cuba to Florida, uh-huh. And then keep the jellyfish away.
It's in the interview that she did. She tells you all about how she got recruited and what happened. It's very interesting.
And so the interview you can find at kkcr.org. Click, go over to the archives, and you'll find all of the interviews we did with Deep Dive. Here's Dr. Yanigahara.
I was funded originally from the U.S. military because there were career-ending combat diver stings, and so part of the grant required that I include a reduction to practice and a business plan. I'm a full-time academic.
Right.
I told them I didn't have time for that, and they said, oh, no, we need a proposal from you. And I kind of fought them, and they said, look, all you have to do is contact the UH School of Business and UH College of Pharmacy. They can help you with these things. They're not that hard to do. So I finally did all that. And then I found something that worked, I mean, just remarkably, across the board, this copper gluconate. So I partnered with UH Hilo School of Pharmacy, and I partnered with folks at UH Manoa School of Business to do the reduction to practice. So we have, and it had to be available to the public. So we have this little website, which does not look professional. It's stingnomore.com, but...
Right.
It's required because of the military funding required that it be available. But frankly, a proper entrepreneur should pick this up and bring it because it gets ordered worldwide. And we've spent zero on advertising, and this year-over-year sales keep building. And we kind of kid
our
compounding pharmacist that, you know, we need to kind of keep on the down low. Otherwise, you know, it's a economy of scale. But
I think it's a great product. I'm going to order some. But okay, and I will tell everybody too. But how do you know how many people are stung? Is there any Department of Health research? I mean, data on that? Or
well, the month that I ended up in an ambulance, there were 1,000 stings reported in Waikiki. So some months it's just, you know, off the hook in terms of the numbers.
Is this month going to be bad? We're now at a full moon, and we're how many days?
I can't predict it.
You can't predict it.
No.
All right. So let's, before we do NIAID, what message would you give people for this, you know, to, you know, schools and just lifeguards and visitors as a form of messaging. I know the guards are aware of all this because they'll say something about it, right, when they're around, or not.
Well, no. I might step on some toes right now, but just forgive me because...
That's okay. We're all here.
You've asked me. So what I would say is I'm kind of upset about ocean safety, city and county. It seems that, I haven't checked in lately, but it seems, last I heard, that the first aid that they were putting out was ice packs. And ice packs, in fact, the reason for that is that it has to be something that can be at every lifeguard stand in the state.
How and about so, your formula?
So it's a dry thing that you can add water to and get cold. But all of the data, my papers, all the retrospective, show worse outcome with the application of ice or cold. Now, that being said, here comes a stung person and they're in great pain. We put ice on them and we ask them their pain score for 10 minutes and their pain goes down, okay? So it looks like it's working. An hour after that though, it's back on and it's tenfold. So if at the beginning you had put heat pack on them, the pain goes down and an hour later it stays down. So this is all published literature. Basically, right. The cold super activates the venom. It stops biology for a moment. As long as they're right there next to the lifeguard stand, things look good. But then they get home or to their hotel, and then they end up showing up in the ER 6 hours later. And now they have much more pathology. They've got real wounding. They've got huge inflammation. They've got all kinds of other problems. So this isn't just my work. We've done retrospectives of worldwide first aid. So I'll send you those papers as well. I mean, I'd like to get ocean safety off of this idea that it doesn't matter if it's hot or cold. And now, it's true, it doesn't matter while they're next to you, but it does matter with regard to outcomes. And that's what we should care about. We should care about the outcome 24 hours later. I've had people call me who were stung days or weeks ago, and they're still suffering all kinds of complications because they didn't have the right first aid from the beginning. So if we could get the state of Hawaii to at least have a uniform treatment plan or mitigation of dousing of vinegar and then hot packs that stay on the site for at least 30 minutes, we could have moved the needle towards a positive, better outcomes.
So I would say, because I was just talking to Kalani Vieira, is going to be on the show in November, who's head of the Hawaii Lifeguard Association and also part of OSB here on Kauai. It makes sense to me that why aren't they all in their packs carrying your product? It makes total sense because you're saying, yes, for the moment, it doesn't hurt, but then that visitor, that local person goes back and ends up in the hospital or some other stressful situation, and that doesn't make sense at all. It makes sense to use a product, and they should at least be a test pilot to say, let's try it out here on this island, this product, that you've done evidence-based research to show that this works.
Well, so in the Philippines, where refrigeration isn't an option for most of the places where I'm working, we make a double-strength spray, and it's been life-saving. So having kind of an all-in-one spray, so it has vinegar plus urea plus the double-strength copper. So the cream is sort of a first world luxury because it gets right into the bloodstream quickly in this very sophisticated base, but it's fussy, it has to be refrigerated. But when you're stung, you have all these little trauma wound sites. So basically, even in the context of vinegar and urea, you can get that copper into the wound sites. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, having something else on the shelf throughout the state of Hawaii, that might be a good first step. Because I agree that it would be hard for them to all have, you know, kept cool Sting No More cream. But I think that originally was part of the pushback, that it was a bit too fussy for them to have But because we've had to kind of go there with regard to helping in the Philippines, we now have 10 years of data. And so this Sting-No-More has been available, you know, over the counter for over 10 years and, you know, over 60,000 units sold and no adverse responses ever recorded. So it's safe, it's effective, and the spray is very hardy and, you know, a good shelf life and robust. The cream, there are some comments about that, but if you have a really bad sting, you would like the cream because that gets the proper concentration over the entire area of the sting, and it's just easier to manage than a drippy spray.
Well, I think that makes sense, and it's based on, you know, peer-reviewed research. I just think what you said about ice packs is really, you know, the problem here. That's contraindicative to any kind of sting. So, you know, yes, it's going to numb it for a while, but it'll come back probably even worse from what you're saying. So we've got OSB we can work on. I'll talk to Kalani and see what he can do about grabbing some of this and having it in there at their towers for sure. I don't understand why they don't want to or haven't thought about it or whatever, but it's certainly an issue you've brought up. What else could you say to schools or, I don't know, visitors in general about not putting ice, put vinegar and hot water is kind of what you're saying is a remedy, and possibly buying your product, you know, Sting No More?
Well, first of all, to the visitors and maybe even to the Hawaii tourism is a little better signage, because it turns out that a lot of our folks go swimming. I've been out there collecting jellies in a full wetsuit with gloves and seeing skinny dippers, you know, at 3 a.m. And we're saying, like, we're collecting very dangerous box jellies right now. You might not want to be swimming. Oh, we'll watch out for them. They're drunk. They're nude. It's dark. Yeah. And then just wait for it. And then you hear the cry, ah, what do we do? What do we do? And so, but too often, you know, these are foreign folks who don't even, you know, understand. So I think that the beaches should all have better, you know, pictures of the jelly, exactly when they're going to come, you know, the maybe a replaceable sort of general calendar for the year, for the next 6 months, more signage and more warning. So you have folks coming from around the world and they see on the plane the little video about Hawaii flora and fauna and, you know, don't bring pests here, etc.
Right.
But there's never any mention about box jellyfish, when and where they are. So it feels a little bit like there could be more information on the front end, at least to protect tourists.
Yes.
The towers don't get their lifeguards until 8 or 9 a.m. and we see a great deal of stings between 6 and 8 a.m. So early morning, and then basically they'll put up a jelly sign if they've had so many stings. So it's almost reactive rather than proactive. And then, you know, in terms of just telling children to wear rash guards and to have better coverage during this time, or, you know, to have little brochures in hotels. I just feel like we could do a better job. Yes. In the front end, in the public education piece.
So the really interesting part there is that most jellyfish stings happen in the mornings.
Yes.
And messaging about covering yourself up in the water, which is not as fun for many people, but especially your kids that aren't, you know, that can get stung, cover yourself up, protect yourself.
Well, what's interesting about this is that Kalani got a hold of Kurt Lager and we've had a discussion, and now they're going to have a Zoom call, Dr. Yanagihara and OSB about, and Dr. Clifford, who is their doctor for OSB in Honolulu, about putting her product into their, in, as a priority in their first aid. So that's moving along, and that's great because she has a good product, and why not have that? And if you listen to the interview, she goes into great detail about what happens.
Yeah, and if you've ever been stung by a jellyfish, you will want to listen to the interview and to align your experience with what she says and goes, wow, I really could have had a better time.
Yes, and once again, she was responsible for Diane Nyad making that 100-mile swim from Cuba to Florida because of her protocol. So that's a very interesting part, too.
Yeah,
so.
And I feel like her protocol could also just help me out for a 20-minute
so
splash
Sting,
around.
You can get this product at stingnomore.com, and that's what we got.
Okay, so our next clip for this section of Deep Dive, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Deep Dive into Water Safety, where we explore topics and interview experts in their field about keeping us safe in the water. So our next clip is with Kalani Vieira, and he is that chief?
Yeah, he's the Ocean Safety Bureau chief for the County of Kauai, and he really has played a pivotal role in water safety his entire career. But we're going to listen to one excerpt of him talking about lifeguards as first responders.
Right. My personal freak out when we aired him live last month was when Kalani started lifeguarding in like 1992. There were 15 lifeguards for the entire island of Kauai, and I had to interrupt and go, what? 15, and now we've got over 80.
We've got 73 lifeguards.
73, okay. Still, like, not quite enough, you know?
And 4 girl lifeguards.
4 lady lifeguards. Yep. We're very pleased about that here. So here's Kalani.
Residents underestimate conditions, too. What would you say are the top 2-3 things locals need to remember every time they go to the beach?
Well, you know, me being born and raised here in Hawaii, sometimes the locals feel that they're invincible, and you know, we really got to remind ourselves that we're part of you know, something, that we got to know our limits. You know, be comfortable with your limits. Not because I'm a local and born here that I can go out in 20-foot surf. Obviously, knowing your limits, knowing the conditions. A lot of guys don't really, or a lot of people don't really pay attention to the weather and the reports. So knowing your limits, knowing the conditions, and when in doubt, don't go out. I think that's the simplest I can put it.
Right. A second question I have here, and then I want to go on to collaboration, and then I want to talk about your book, which is really exciting. Lifeguards are often the first responders to ocean emergency. What is one thing you wish the public understood better about what lifeguards actually do?
Good question. So, you know, when I started back in the mid-90s, you know, we didn't have much respect as lifeguards because we just was considered the beach boys, you know, of all the equipment that we had and, you know, uniforms we had, and, you know, we didn't have much. But today, it's a way more professional job. We have a career ladder involved now with lieutenants, captains, and chiefs, and rescue craft operators. So, you know, people need to understand that the lifeguards, I think we should make up a new name for lifeguards. We should be called the initial responders, because we're there well before any first responder is, like fire or police or medic. We're there before even the incidents happen. We most of the times make the initial call of what's going on. Our jobs have grown and responsibilities have grown tremendously in the last 20 plus years of not only dealing with what's going on in the water, but there's a lot of things that goes on the beach. There's a lot of things that going on behind of the tower, like the path and the roads. We deal with so much different things nowadays that it's beyond just water activities. We deal with car accidents. We deal with bike accidents on the bike path. We deal with assaults, knife stabbings. We dealt with gunshot wounds, fires, injured hikers. I mean, we pretty much do it all. You know, marine life at the beach. And we're the only people that has some kind of authority at the beach. A lot of people go to the beach and they come running to the lifeguards thinking that we can solve everything. But just the amount of responsibility that the lifeguards have. You know, if you're having a problem at home, you're going to have to detach your problem, because when you show up to work, you have to be on your toes. I remember going to work by myself. I didn't do any physical activities because it was busy. I didn't have the time. But when I went home, I was so exhausted mentally because of just being alert for the 8 or 10 hour shifts. So hopefully people can understand that our guards are out there. You know, you might have a different perception of what they do, but you have to be on your toes. You have to be in constant shape. You have to be ready to respond. If you're having doubts in your mind, you know, you have to clear your mind and be dedicated to your job, because the people is relying on you to come to work. Your team, your coworkers are relying you to come to work. So you got to really put your ego on the side and come to work with a positive attitude, with patience, so you can, when you go home after you work, at least you can go home and tell yourself, in my heart, I did the best I can today, and I'm going home safe to my family.
That's well said. And Dwayne DeSoto actually talked about the community that's going in the ocean. Respect the ocean, and also understand, if you go out in risky situations, that there is someone that's going to have to risk their life to come after you. And so you need to think about that. So thank you for that piece of information about the lifeguards. You said in an interview I just heard recently that you thought lifeguards should be considered first responders. And
yeah, we got to figure out a proper
right
term. You know, initial responders, we got to think of a better term.
Before we go on to this, I think our listeners should know that lifeguards are not considered first responders. And that's a piece of legislation that probably should be changed.
We are working on that as we speak. Just a quick comment on that. I just went to the USLA conference about a month and a half ago in Idaho. And the USLA is working on a resolution. So we're going to be meeting with some of our legislation representatives to help co-sponsor this resolution to have our state or federal recognize lifeguards as first responders, because that's ridiculous that the lifeguards are not considered or recognized as first responders.
That's good news.
That is good news.
It is very good news.
Yes.
And also drawing from our first clip, which is of the Bondi Beach lifeguards
right
being the initial responders while the shooting was still happening.
Right.
Yeah, to give lifeguards worldwide the sort of respect and the sort of training and recognition for what they do for us.
We didn't talk about what Kalani has done. I mean, he's lifeguard and world famous for what he does, but he's also an actor. He's in Chief of War, Episode 8, which is very interesting. But he's also author of a book called The Hawaiian Lifeguard. It's the first book out. It's all education for young kids. It can be purchased on the Hawaii Lifeguard Association website or Amazon.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we have one more clip, which I find fascinating, but also another portion, our intro music is also downloadable as
yes
well.
It's Children of the Sea by Nakama Kai. Mm-hmm. And it can be gotten at Apple or Spotify. Also, the progress there is that Dwayne DeSoto and Nakama Kai have had a pilot swim program for fourth graders going on Oahu and Makana area. So that's been very successful, and we will have the Department of Education coming on in the beginning of the year talking about the progress they're making in water safety education. So I'm looking forward to that.
And water safety education, everyone that you've interviewed says is like, oh yeah, that's key.
Right.
That is like the number one thing that you can do. And I was talking with Representative Jill Tokuda, and she's like, oh yeah, fourth grade, we all did water safety. Like, we just learned about it. That was just what it is, you know? And we don't do that anymore. And Hawaii has the second highest drowning rate in the nation.
Well, we're making progress. Yeah. Kamakai did a great job. Dwayne DeSoto and Matt Cowie did a great job with that program
in
the summer.
So progress coming back. So that CD that you can download if you want to is Children of the Sea, Na Kamakai, and it's the Haku Keiki.
Yes.
Singing really cute and informative songs about being safe in the water. So our next and final clip.
Yeah, we've been talking about messaging, and we were going to play a clip that we were talking about cultural messaging. Everybody from the mayor who's been on the show, everyone has said, how do we get better messaging? But we took this clip from Kainamakua. He also played in Chief of War, and he is a taro farmer and also runs a project over on the west side. Kalei Clark, who is also somebody we interviewed, who's from New Zealand, did some research that found one of the statistics about Native Hawaiians drowning at a proportional higher rate. So he had a question for Kainamakua, who was also one of our interviews. So that's what we're going to hear about messaging.
Love it.
For Kalahui, what is next for our people? What is next for... yeah, Hawaiian people.
Could talk about water safety.
What is next for all of our Lahui? I'm gonna leave with this. I think my good friend of mine, Nick Tilson, he runs NDN Collective. Native American organization, and He said this in one of his conference presentations, as he was one of the keynote speakers, and he said, "We gotta create more new ceremonies. Create new ceremonies, and whatever that looks like, you know, it really was. To me, I was like, wow, yeah, it's cool, because we have ceremonies that we do now that have been created hundreds of years ago." For that time, for that era, but nothing that we've created now, and thinking about that, and thinking about our conversation now, yeah, it's a ceremony. This we trying to create a positive impact on our swimming community, on the ocean, and make it global. How do we do that? How do we ensure that everyone buys into the ceremony, whatever that ceremony looks like and is? Whether it's spreading awareness, whether it's actually doing the do and teaching the youth, it's still in a way a ceremony. And how do we ensure that everybody is level-headed, understands their role, understands their kuleana, so that, you know, we can all be well-educated, make the right choice at the right time, at the very high percentage. And, you know, decrease those numbers, maybe even get it to nothing one day. I don't know, but it's a ceremony nonetheless. And that would be my pitch, and that would be my answer to John's question, Kalei's question. Create more ceremonies of our time.
I thought that was a great message. And I think we're really thankful for everybody that came on the show for the last almost 6 months, 24 people almost, mm-hmm. who have really tried to amplify the message that drowning is preventable. And working with the 2025 Water Safety Plan, I think we've identified people in that plan that we've talked to, and I think we've moved the needle. A lot of the people that we've talked about today and these highlights have made a difference. And so we will continue this progress on water safety into the new year.
Mm-hmm. And we've said it before, you can look for the podcast coming nationally distributed that you can share with your friends. You can also listen to every episode of Deep Dive and all of the interviews from around the world at kkcr.org. And just one more time, I'm going to commend you, Margaret, for finding all of these experts and asking them these hard questions.
Well, there's so many people that want to talk about it and have a passion for it, and we'll continue this mm-hmm. message.
Yes, and I'm thankful for it. You've been listening to Deep Dive into Water Safety. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll
see you in the new year.
See you in the new year. Oh, come on. You can do it. Before you jump in, a ho'olohe pono to me. When in doubt, don't go out. Never turn your back on the sea.